Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. My name's John Connors. I'm the host of this podcast, and I'm the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts. We're right here in Norwood, Massachusetts. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, mixed martial arts, and more than that, we can help you transform your life. If you're looking for more confidence, you want to get in better shape, if you want to become a badass, just reach out to us. Our website is connorsma.com. You can send me an email. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, all the usual places. My name's John Connors, C-O-N-N-O-R-S. And Power of the Tribe podcast is where we discuss finding a tribe to help you make the change that you want in your life. Make that positive change. Lose weight, gain confidence, whatever you want to do, the right tribe can help you do it. And I'm here, as usual, with my great co-host, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing all right.
Awesome. Okay. You are usually doing all right.
I'm doing okay.
It's just a perfunctory thing. I do care if you're all right.
Yeah, I know. It's just an expression.
It's an expression.
But I noticed that people be like, how you doing? I'll be like, yeah, good. And they're like, what's wrong? I'm like, it's like you have to say amazing.
Oh, is that the new thing?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, I'm doing okay.
Right? Yeah.
I'm like, fine.
Right, right. Not very often you're doing terrible, right?
Almost never.
Yeah. That's good. That's a good place to be coming from, man. So today, I thought, as our framework, you know, I came up with 17 benefits of a tribe, finding the right tribe. And, you know, we've talked to people before. We talked about tribe. You know, I was thinking about this. It's not like you need one tribe. You know, back in the Stone Age, you had your one tribe, your 50 people or whatever the heck it was, 150. And that was your tribe. And you probably didn't interact with strangers too much. But it's a different world now. You know, so it doesn't have to be just one tribe that you're involved in. It's not like going into a cult or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you ever been in a cult?
No, I did not have the cult-like personality at any point in my life.
Right.
And no offense to those of everyone out there that has the cult-like personality or is in a cult. But I remember like in high school, I think in the 80s is when cults started becoming big.
They had a big comeback in the 80s.
Yeah, something. I'm sure they were big earlier than that, like Joe. Yeah. But they sent people through the high schools that were like, or junior high, or that range that was like, the theme being, you know, don't join a cult.
Don't get caught in a cult.
And I remember them, the police officer or the cult expert or whoever, would be talking about joining cults and, you know,
really?
Sort of saying, this is how they suck you in. And I'd sit there the whole time like, who would get sucked in by that? Like who, you know?
So it was like, sort of like a just say no campaign.
Yeah, or someone would, or people would come in and say they had been in a cult.
Right.
And say, here's how, and then every step of the way that they were sucked in, I think to myself, that would not appeal to me at all.
Well, I think what they're trying to do is qualify for people who are either very gullible or in a vulnerable point in their life. I heard that with that spam email where, you know, a Nigerian bank sends you an email and you've inherited $1 billion. They make it as dopey as possible, so the only people that reply are people that are really vulnerable. So so they try not to be realistic. They try to make it as unrealistic as possible.
But I think it'd be harder for me because, you know, the step up, they'd be like, the first thing is the cult member walks up to you, and I'd be like, I'm out already. Because if anyone walks up to me, I'm like, why are you walking up to me? Like, that's my first thought
right.
of anyone walking up to me at
that,
any time.
Is at
like,
that step.
Why are you...
Right.
Why are you coming and talking to me if I don't know you?
That first step. Yeah. You're not waiting to the, now we're going to castrate you, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, aren't you that way? I don't know. If I'm out in the public and someone walks up to me, my first thought is like, why are you talking to me? What is this?
I think is that a city thing or an East Coast thing?
I think so. I was picturing myself in the streets of Manhattan when I was picturing
that.
Like someone goes, hey, and you're like, well, what is this now?
Yeah,
what is
I'm either
like?
Going to be losing money here.
Yeah.
Something not good is going to happen.
Yeah,
to me.
A mugging or money.
Somebody from over here is going to crack me in the head while I'm talking to this guy.
Yeah.
Or he's going to make me feel really guilty and I'm going to give him $20 or something.
Yeah, exactly. So
urban.
Or just,
East
or
Coast
just coming
thing.
Up. Yeah. Can I ask you something? You're like, oh, boy.
Shit.
Yeah, exactly. What is this?
Here we go.
Like the most innocent. Yeah, exactly. The most innocent intro. So let alone a cult person coming up like, hey, do you want to go to a really fun party? It'd be like, are you kidding me?
I do exactly the same thing. I think I was in Forest Hills, and this guy started walking up behind me, and my spidey senses, I knew it. And he goes, hey, you got a cigarette? And I'm like, I'm out. I'm not even acknowledging this nitwit, you know. And then he kept saying it, and he like kind of got my attention. And I said, no, I don't smoke. Oh, how do you get to Cleary Square from here? I'm like, so you, is that where you live? Yeah. So you don't know how to get home. Yeah. You're a grown man, and you don't know how to get home, which is like 2 miles away. So yeah, I'm exactly this. So the next thing was, you know, I need $5 for bus fare or something this. Right. Yeah. So I'm exactly the same. So I would totally
agree. Or even the kindest entry, you know, like, hey, I'm going to sing you in a song, you and your wife a song or something. You're like, oh, get it. Don't sing me a song. I don't need to hear a song. Or just, or even, hey, would you like this for free? I'm just giving it away. Like, nope, I don't want it.
My college roommate was from a small town in Missouri. And I remember walking down the streets of Cambridge with him, and a car would honk, and he would turn around and wave. I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, well, I thought they were saying hello. It might be somebody I know. Somebody you know from your small town in Missouri. Would be hunk. But it was just a different environment. So back...
I had a friend back way back when that came from Iowa. And he actually originally landed in Manhattan, like, or got off the train or whatever in Manhattan, and immediately lost money to like three-card Monte. Like the three-card Monte, like to like... They were ripping people off 1,000 years ago with that game, like the shell game.
It's endless, right?
And he was sort of, the shell wasn't under any of them, or the queen wasn't under any of them, or whatever, whichever version he was playing. He was like, no, 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 that's wrong, because there was another guy winning.
You know what? A guy I went to college with who was from Las Vegas, and his dad was a card dealer. He went to Manhattan on a job interview and did the three-card Monte thing and lost his money. And he told me about him, and I was flabbergasted. Yeah. I said, aren't you from Las Vegas? You haven't heard of this thing? Your dad's a card dealer, and you fell for this? Yeah. I couldn't believe it, but Manhattan thing or big city thing.
I know, and there can be a downside. I think sometimes I'd be in, like, say, Amherst or, you know, some kind of nice town, and someone go, hey, can I ask you something? I'd be like, yeah, no, no, no.
Back then, off, mister.
Yeah, exactly. They have like a legitimate, like, I was wondering where I could buy a, you know, like, I was wondering where I could buy stationery or, you know, something where,
yeah,
like, all right, calm down. You know. But each step, and then they'd be like, so the cult thing would be get on the bus. And then it was like, and it seems all great at first. You're all singing a song and they have you clap and sing. And for me, I'm like, so hell. You know what I mean? Like, that's how they suck you in, with like the most unappealing possible.
Singing,
like,
on a bus?
Yeah.
I think I'd rather walk. Yeah. I'm out.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate those 99 bottles of beer thing. What is that? Yeah. I would lose.
And then
my
they
mind.
All sort of, then they say, you know, they start with slight, I don't know why we're talking about cults, by the way, but they sort of, I guess, belonging to a,
yeah,
I ask a small favor. And again, even, you know, I was 15, 14 and thinking, as soon as they asked the favor, my thought would be, oh, okay, I see. I see where this is. I see what this is all about. But people seem endlessly, you know, up until the point where they're...
Well, I imagine those people are... They have some knowledge of the human nervous system and sort of the way the mind works, and they sort of take advantage of it, right? What is that called with those... It's not cognitive dissonance. It's those things where the brain sort of makes mistakes because of heuristics. So, like, if reciprocity, if I give you a flower, then now you feel obligated to me, even though you didn't want the flower anyway. So then I can start to manipulate.
Right. You give, all those.
Cognitive biases, right? Yeah. Isn't that what it's called?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things. But I remember the studies from way back when, where it was like the 60s, I think, even. It was like, give someone a dollar, or like, do you want a Coke at the beginning of the thing, at the experiment? And then they'll give back a lot more. You know, you give the slightest favor, and then they're twice as likely to donate 2 hours of their time or something like that,
right?
Because, like, you gave them a Coke, or, you know. Right. So it's that idea. You give some little thing and end up getting.
So, Dan, don't join any cults.
Has your computer seen better days? Is it always freezing and lagging? Are you constantly plagued with pop-ups and viruses? Are you not able to get any work done? You don't need a new computer. You need Phoenix Technology Support. With just one call to Phoenix Technology Support, you will never have to stress over the hassles of taking your computer to a repair shop again. Just leave your computer right where it is and let us come directly to you. Phoenix Technology Support has over 10 years of experience in the industry of customer support and IT solutions, and it's the best place for help with all of your home or business electronics. From gaming systems to tablet setups, smartphones to smart TVs, even business servers and emails. We will help set up or troubleshoot almost any technology in your home or office. So next time you think your technology is at the end of its life, have it rise from the ashes like a phoenix by calling Phoenix Technology Support at 617-658-3240. That's 617-658-3240, or go to www.phoenixtechboston.com.
So the idea, though, is healthy tribes.
Healthy tribes, right. And I guess my point was, you don't have to join something that's all-inclusive. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you have your family and you have your community that you live with and maybe your company that you work with. And then, like, you get, like, we when we talked to Pedro, he got a little tribe that was going to help him work out. So it fills a certain need for you, you know, in your life. It doesn't have to be all-consuming, but it's still going to be very effective. So I wrote down 17 benefits of tribe.
It's a lot of benefits.
It's a lot of the probably, you know, 8 of them overlap, or I just probably wrote the same thing at 16 that I did at number 3. So I doubt we'll get through all of them, but I figured this would be a good framework for a podcast we could go through.
Yeah, I'm assuming we're not going to go one. You know, like,
right. Well, we're going to go 1, 2, 3. We're going to go through them, but we probably won't get to 17. And you can jump in and be funny.
Well, we didn't even get to 1 yet.
We haven't got to 1, I know.
We're on a pace.
What minute are we in here? Yeah. Yeah, we're on a pace that 17 is unlikely. Yeah. But it'll be good. So the number one I have is, when you join a tribe, you can get a cultural expectation of success. So I talked about this before. So, you know, expectation of success is very important. If we don't think we can succeed, it's going to be hard for us to work hard and put a lot of effort into something. But if we join this tribe that's enjoying success, that can be sort of a proxy for our own expectation of success and raise that. And the classic example I brought up was Andrew Jones of the 1996 Atlanta Braves. So I came across this in The Talent Code, Daniel Coyle's book, which is a great book. And what happened is, this young man came up as a rookie, I think, in the World Series. And his first two at-bats in the World Series, hit home runs. And he was a sensation. And he was from the island of Curaçao. So then all the little leaguers in Curaçao said, I want to be like Andrew Jones. And suddenly they became a force in baseball, at least at the little league level. I don't know how they're doing otherwise. And it took about, I think, 4 or 5 years for it to really kick in. But, you know, this tiny island nation, the only thing that was different was their expectation of success. They saw one of their own succeeding, and they said,
I think it's doable.
We could do that. Have you ever experienced that, a cultural expectation of success? Have you ever stepped into something and raised your own standard?
For me, I would say I felt, nothing's coming to mind, because I felt the opposite sometimes, where I feel like I'm swimming.
You ran over your head a little bit.
Against it, yeah, where I'm swimming against it. I think it was that the town I grew up in, a lot of people had a lot of money. And
right.
And I went to a school where a lot of people had a lot of money. And I think it was more like, this is going to be a bit tougher for me. All right. Then I got to graduate school and I had no idea what it was. I don't know if we talked about that at all, but I got to graduate school and I sort of thought, what do I even do here?
Right.
Like, I didn't even know.
I don't know. What do you do there?
Thinking, I'm still not sure. But I sort of felt like other people I think know what they're doing here and know what they, so I felt almost the opposite, where I didn't have the model in front of me. So I felt this effect, but I think in the negative way, where I felt I don't have a model, I don't have.
But you felt a pull, a stress to probably step up your game. You've probably felt like, shoot, I'm not as prepared as these people. I better buckle down and try to figure this out.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah.
But and so take it to the gym, too. That was another thing where I talked a little bit about how I started. It was blind walking in. You know,
right.
I walked in blind. And I think a lot of people have to start that way, right? Where you just come in,
yep,
like that. And that's where we talked, and I'm sure we'll talk again, about getting out of your comfort zone.
Because
it's hard. A few people come in comfortable with the situation. You know, they said,
right,
I know my brother does it, or I wrestled for 8 years. But most people come in pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I all entered a lot of situations uncomfortable. And I think the lesson you learn from each of these things is, every single one, whether it's the gym or graduate school or college or high school, whatever it was, you or any new job I've been in, soon you realize, like, okay, this is not that tough. You know, it's not that uncomfortable. It's not that big a deal. Everyone here's the same as me.
Everyone comes in as a novice.
Yeah.
And has to figure it out anyways.
And I've always thought there's this other thing, and I don't know if this is even tangential, but that everyone comes in as a novice and feels they don't understand this idea that the people that have been there a while aren't paying that much attention to them.
To them.
Yeah. You sort of feel like, so you've seen it in the gym where you spar with someone or roll with someone and they spend the whole time like nervously chattering and apologizing to you. Like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. And you know, like as,
right.
Oh, sorry. Is that the right thing? Am I supposed to do? And you just feel like many, many times I've had to be like, just it's fine. Don't worry about whatever you're doing is fine.
Right.
And I always use the example of skiing, where I didn't ski until college.
Okay.
And you go up on the gondola.
Right.
And you get off and you're kind of stumbling around. Mm. And you sort of, I remember thinking, all the good skiers are looking at me and they're like laughing. And they're like, yeah. Look at this guy. He can't do anything. What I realized later was all the good skiers have seen 1,000 guys just like me. You know, they see
doesn't even register.
Yeah,
at all.
They're like, yeah, they're not.
Off the lift and they're finding whatever they're
exactly the corner of their eyes, someone falling down, and they
could
like,
care less.
Yeah, could care less. They've seen it again and
unless
again.
Unless you get like caught in the thing and whip around a bunch of times like a maniac,
hanging by my ski from the. Yeah, I was hanging down from the thing, going. They've seen this a million times. There's no one's even paying any attention to this. I'm sure as they shut it down. And,
like they see skiing him. Is funny because I always had the sense that it's sort of a rich person's sport. So it brings that extra social pressure. So you're going up the skiing thing and you hadn't skied since college and all these rich people have been doing it their whole lives and they know how to do it. And there is plenty of opportunity for you to sort of figuratively and realistically fall on your face.
Yeah.
So I could see how that could be nerve-wracking. But it's funny how it's a fear of embarrassment, social embarrassment, not really a fear of getting hurt.
We've talked about that too. There's some fear of getting hurt, but
right.
Even literally people getting to fight in a cage, which is as scary as it gets physically. We talked about this on an earlier show where the fear is always, I don't want to get embarrassed. I've never heard one fighter saying, I'm scared of getting hurt or hit.
I think that's the greatest fear. I think sometimes they are, depending on their opponent. Yeah. They might go, oh my God.
Well, sort of like skiing. Sometimes you're scared on the mountain, like I'm going to hit a tree. But
that fear of embarrassment in front of people is the most powerful fear, I think.
Haven't you heard that the fear of public speaking is the worst?
Yeah, that's Jerry Seinfeld's old joke, right? That it's greater than the fear of dying. So people would rather be in the casket than up in front of the group saying a eulogy. Yeah. That's definitely the case. And I think, what do you think is more nerve-wracking? Failing and getting embarrassed in front of people you know or in front of strangers? Probably people you know, right?
I think people you know.
Yeah.
Because I know, again, I'm thinking of these kinds of things, either whether it's, you know, we always give this sort of extreme example of fighting, but it's also just giving a speech or dancing or singing.
Right.
And what I hear all the time is, like, I just don't want people I know to go.
Right.
Not everyone's
like
that, but I hear that all the time where they say, I'd rather you didn't go. Or take my kids. They do a lot of performing, singing, and acting, and they feel way more comfortable if they don't. Like, if they had to do the same thing but in front of their high school, they'd feel much more uncomfortable than, you know, somewhere, you know, the next town over.
So the unspoken fear or even the unarticulated fear is that they're going to lose social standing in their group. They don't even realize it, but that's the
thing. Is that it? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so, because you have some sort of pecking order, some sort of order of status. And if you fall on your face, you're going to get knocked down a few rungs.
So even for someone like giving a speech, it could be, say you babble and you sweat and you're sort of, in somewhere subconsciously, you might think, the people I know thought I would be cooler than this.
Yeah.
And now they think less of me because they thought I could handle it.
Yes, and that's very painful. And I think it's because of that selfish gene theory. So our genes want to reproduce and survive. And if you go down a couple rungs on the social status ladder, you have less reproducing options. So that's painful to the selfish gene. And we experience it as anxiety and we just feel
right.
Crappy.
That's all subconscious, obviously. That's
completely
all,
unconscious.
Yeah, unconscious. Yeah.
I never knew any about this until I started reading about the selfish gene and evolutionary psychology and these subjects. I just knew, oh my God, I don't want to embarrass myself. That's how most people think, right?
Yeah,
they don't even know why they feel that, but it's powerful, right?
Yeah.
And it's so limiting, which is a shame. I heard Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller. He said that Jillette says, fear of embarrassment is the worst reason not to do something. but it's a very powerful reason. And if you think about it, if you're giving a speech, you're probably better off swinging for the fences and taking a big chance to make a big impact instead of like playing it safe and then people don't even remember what the heck you said, right? Or what happened.
Yeah. It's a good point because I still think even as a novice, the main impediment to like joining a tribe or trying something new is that fear of embarrassment, right?
Fear of embarrassment. Yeah, it is. Definitely. And probably fear of getting hurt too or something, but I think fear of embarrassment. You're going to go in and people are going to judge you to be inadequate and shun you, which is painful. And
right.
But it would never really happen, especially at my right. academy. But I think that is a fear. Definitely.
But that's an example of whether it's a skiing or your academy or whatever. Mm. It's always the fear is like the number one obstacle, and then it never happens, or like it happens so much less
right.
than people are scared of it happening. You know what I mean? It's really not that common that people really badly embarrass themselves. And then there's a follow-up where if you do embarrass yourself, it's not really actually that big a deal.
Doesn't stick that long or hard, right? It really doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can totally recover no matter how badly you embarrass yourself. And if you're constantly throwing yourself out there, you're going to have so many spectacular wins, they're going to overshadow the losses, you know?
Yeah.
I see that in fighting. Remember Randy Couture? If you look up his record, and Dan Henderson, I think, is like this, too. They have a fair number of losses on their record. It's not perfect at all.
BJ Penn.
But you don't even remember their losses because, especially with Randy Couture and Dan Henderson, the way they approached fighting, you know, they just came at it well-prepared. They always gave their best effort. They always fought with... And Dan Henderson might still be fighting. I shouldn't talk to him about it in the past tense, but they always fought with courage and, you know what I mean, real enthusiasm and going for it. So... when you lose like that, you don't even remember the loss. You just remember them as going for it.
Yeah, you can't even remember who won.
Can't remember. Yeah. I can't remember who they lost to. I vaguely could probably, if you pushed me.
But they're exact, like a long time ago, Dan Henderson fought in rings against Little Nogueira, I think. And I don't remember who won. You know, I just remember, you know, I remember a great match.
Yeah.
Where he was fighting off the submissions, which he didn't know that much about at the
so
time.
So maybe that's the key. They're just always going for it. Instead of, you know, I think if you are too cautious and put all your eggs in one basket, then you're sort of risking it. You know, if you're like, I'm going to go out there that one time and go for it, then it's pretty binary. It's either going to work out for you or not. But if you're consistently putting yourself out there going for it, sooner or later you're going to get some wins. It's going to work out for you, you know.
Yeah.
And those big wins are going to overshadow no matter how many losses you have.
When I'm feeling sluggish, I'm not looking for the jittery feeling of coffee. I'm reaching for Neurosonic, the only energy drink I trust to keep me going. Neurosonic is just one of the great drinks in the neurofunctioning beverages line. When I'm stressing an interview, NeuroBliss keeps me cool, calm, and collected. And when it's time to call it a night, I don't want sleeping pills and all the crazy after effects you hear about. I want NeuroSleep to help me drift off to dreamland. Neuro drinks are surprisingly low calorie and full of the healthiest and most efficacious vitamins and minerals. Artificial flavors and colors don't work for them, and neither should they for you, so they don't allow them in their drinks. To find a store near you that carries Neuro, go to drinknero.com or visit amazon.com to order a 12-pack. Neuro, drink with a purpose.
Okay, so number two on our
sure
benefits.
One was that, like...
What was a cultural expectation of success?
Yeah.
That's important.
We just ended up with a lot of different points there.
That's all right. That's all right, Dan. It was very entertaining. So number two is positive peer pressure. So there's so much talk of negative peer pressure. You're going to start drinking and doing drugs when you're a young person because of your peers. But you can sort of change your standards and get positive pressure. So, you know, I think I'm fitter than I would be because I want to be a good role model for my students at my academy. And it forces me to be a little bit better.
Yeah. I had an early example that just, and maybe this is broad societal example, but I went to a good high school, saying it was a town where just everyone went to college and a lot of kids went to really good schools. And you didn't have to be like the best student to have in the back of your mind, I'm going to go to a good school. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So I think you take that same, or myself, right, who was kind of, you know, social, like going out, like hanging out with friends, going to parties and stuff, like, but if that same kid is in a school where half the people go to college, then, you know, I probably still go, but it gets a lot shakier of where I end up. Mm. You know, sort of, so you end up like, I'm out with a bunch of friends goofing around all the time, but then we all end up going to a good college. You know, it's sort of, you all have in your head, we're goofing around, but we're all going to end up here.
Right.
And sure. Then if I was the one that wasn't, it would have really been striking, you know, would have really stood out. So really early on, I saw the sort of, and I wasn't like thinking of it directly, but it's sort of, I think of it with when, for my kids, and I think of it for my, you know, my brother's kids, it's sort of like, where are you at school? And is the expectation you're going, just to, let's just take, go to college or not. It's huge, right? Just in a high school.
Definitely.
You know, is if you're at a school where everyone's going, you just think, I'm going.
And you end up doing the behaviors necessary to put you in the position to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just or, as a more concrete example, if the best students are studying constantly, you can sort of feel, well, I'm not one of the best students, but I'm studying an hour a day or whatever it is, 2 hours a day, like, which is a lot for another school.
Right.
Which would be the best students at another school. You sort of feel, well, I'm not a great student, but I'll study 2 hours a day for some place. That's a lot.
Right. It's sort of that old rule of thumb by, I think it's Jim Rohn or somebody. You're the average of the five most important people in your life. You know, so if you have five people in your life that are super fit, it's probably unlikely that you're going to be completely out of shape.
Yeah.
And so,
or so your example also at the academy or in a group, you just feel, I could be there feeling like, well, I'm not that fit compared to a lot of these guys, but you stay kind of fit, you know, you don't.
Right.
Yeah.
If you were hanging out with a group of completely unfit people, you're very, very likely going to become even more out of shape. You're going to slide more into the unfit category.
Because you feel like I'm doing pretty good compared to these guys.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're going to take your foot off the gas and relax a little bit, chill out. So that is basically number five I had.
No.
Elevation of personal standards, right?
Yeah, see, it's going to be hard to go in order here.
That's okay. The other one I had was you can become empowered with a cause greater than yourself. So if you're doing something for the group, sometimes you can do more and actually give something to yourself when you do that.
So you're picturing like someone fighting for the gym and feeling extra motivation to represent well? And
yeah.
Well, I can't remember the numbers, you would, but I remember there was this run that the gym had for a while where it was just completely ridiculous. Like the winning percentage for the gym was just almost unrealistically high, right? Where it just felt like everyone just kept winning.
Yes.
And I always thought, I wondered if how much this played into it. You know, I've just sort of, people would start going into the fights thinking, I'm going to win.
I think so. Yeah. And then they don't want to be the one that ends the streak too. So there's that pressure as well. They're like, I don't want to be the guy. We won 13 in a row. I don't want to be the guy who stops this from going. Yeah, that's a lot of pressure.
So maybe they try a little harder.
I think so. Yeah, they get a little bit sharper. I mean, the challenge for training for a fight is it's so painful. The work is so hard. You got to do so many painful things that you really need a compelling reason to do it in order to keep going every, you know, maybe not every day, but you're training maybe 5 or 6 times a week pretty hard. So you really need a strong why. You really need to be motivated to do that.
Do you think there's a negative there where there's someone that, for example, I picture someone saying, well, I'm not, if we won 13 in a row, I don't want to fight because.
That's a really good point, Dan.
You know?
That's a very good point. That I've heard that described as an ego trap. Did I tell you about this concept before?
I don't remember.
I found this fascinating because I see it happening. I feel it in myself at times, and I see it with other people. So if I get a certain amount of esteem from you, right? Maybe you say, John, you're so good at jiu-jitsu. It's amazing. And I feel like I'm slightly overvalued. You're the best guy around here. Now I'm going to be less motivated to go compete in a tournament because I got nothing to win. And if I don't win the tournament, I might lose esteem from you.
Right.
So, and that's painful. The thought of losing esteem from you is really painful. So it's way easier not to go into that contest.
So you've directly felt that, right?
I've directly felt that. And I've witnessed it with other people too. It's a tricky thing. You know, we're told as parents that we got to always encourage our kids, tell them how smart they are. They can do anything and they're wonderful and they can become president and they can do anything, which sounds good. But I think if you give too much esteem, now you don't give the kid or the athlete or whoever a reason to win. There's nothing for them to win. You're already giving them everything. Yeah. So now they're like, holy cow, Dad thinks I'm so good. If I go out there and I don't win, he's going to think less of me. So that causes, that's the ego trap. So then they don't want to compete. And so maybe they injure their ankle. Like if it's an athletic thing, they're out. They're not going to compete. George St. Pierre was a little bit in that place before he retired. If you remember, he fought Johnny Hendricks.
He took a beating, yeah.
Took a beating, but he won a 5-round decision. And it was a close fight. But he had to win the 5th round in order to get the decision. And he did, and a lot of fans turned on him. He got a lot of kind of hate. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it makes no sense because he pulls it out at the end, and people are mad at him. It's like Tom Brady winning in the 4th quarter, the Super Bowl, and you're not satisfied. And it's something to do with fighting perhaps too, that people really enjoy a definitive decision when somebody knocks somebody out or submits them. They don't like it as much if it goes to
squeaking
the judges.
Out a win, yeah.
Right. And I think GSP found himself in an ego trap where he was like, there's no win here for me. Even when I win, people are not satisfied. God
That's
forbid if
retired,
I lost.
Right?
So he retired, which I think was a very smart thing for him to do. And it gave him a chance to regroup and sort of get out of that ego trap. And notice the fight he took when he came back. He went up a weight class to fight the champion, Michael Bisping. So now he has something to win because people don't really expect him to win.
Yeah.
And it was a really good idea because if he lost to Bisping, he wouldn't lose any esteem from us or respect. We'd be like, yeah, he's still good. He took a shot. He's been off for 3 years or however. He was off for a while, right?
Yeah.
And he's going up a weight class. So he really had nothing to lose and really something exciting to gain, a new belt. You know, he didn't just fight anybody at 185. He fought the champ. So it was just brilliant. And then it was probably smart to retire. I think he had some health issue is the reason why he retired.
Right. But to your point, if he came back and he fought maybe like Tyron Woodley and lost, it might look like, well, he was good for his time, but he's not
exactly.
as good. He had a lot to lose.
He had a lot to lose there. So that was a really smart choice. And those ego traps are very tricky and sneaky, as you notice. Right? And they don't seem to make rational sense on the surface of things until you really think about it. And then it's obviously something that's going on. So I heard about that from that Dr. Doug Lyle, who has the Beat Your Genes podcast. He's an evolutionary psychologist and clinical psychologist. And he explains. So the way he explains it is, here's the Stone Age version of it. I hope I do this right. I think it'll be fine. Some young guy goes out in his first hunt, and he's all by himself, and he comes across a water buffalo who's got his leg stuck in a hole. So he just kills the thing and brings back this meat, and the tribe goes crazy. They go, you're the greatest hunter ever. Your first hunting trip, you killed a water buffalo. You're awesome. And now he's getting, and he knows, I got lucky. And now he's getting overvalued for his abilities by the tribe. So then you know, a week later, we're going out for a hunt. You're one of our best hunters. You got to go out there. Now he's like, holy cow, I can only go down.
Yeah, only go down.
Yeah, when I come back with a muskrat or something. So he twists his ankle and he can't go hunting.
Yeah, that's exact. So like in the gym, if everyone's like, you always win, how can you, you know, you could beat anybody.
Right.
And you can only go down, right? You can only.
It's very tricky.
But then, so the problem then is the solution can be self-handicapping, right? Where you...
What do you mean?
You don't go out on a limb where you, like...
That's the worst thing about it.
But that's exactly how you deal with that, right? That's exactly how you would deal with it. You'd say...
No, the doctor has a prescription for it, actually. So let's say you're...
Well, that's how you unhealthily deal with it, though. I mean, if you self-handicapping, like, so in school...
Oh, yeah.
And I had some of this in college, too, where it's sort of like, oh, you're really smart. You're just a really smart student. And then you kind of think, well, I don't know if I can get all A's.
Mm.
So then you adopt a whole personality. And this is incredibly common, right? Of, I don't even really study.
I didn't study at
all. And I got a B plus. And then inside you're like, I think all I could get is a B plus.
Right.
You know.
So
but,
then you're trying to imply the calculus that I'm really an A plus student if I put any effort in at all.
Yeah. Or you don't work, you know, you don't compete. You don't give your best because you think you don't want people to see you give your best.
Right.
And come up short.
Yeah.
So you never give your best, you know, and
or at least you make it known that you're not giving your best.
Yeah. Or make it seem. Yeah. imply right. you're not giving your best.
Exactly.
And that's when excuses happen, and that's when, you know, you just sort of say, I didn't even, and, you know, and you even hear it with a lot of fighters, right? Like, it's like, hey, good performance. And you go, yeah, and that was with, I didn't even, that was with my right. bad elbow.
And staff you know, infection. And
my staff,
else.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you want to say that I'm actually even higher than this.
Even better than that.
Yeah. And yeah. that's incredibly common, right?
Very common.
Yeah. So the, what's the healthy
the healthy way? I don't know if it's healthy. What he says is, so let's say you have a child, you're a parent, and you see the child's in an ego trap, and they don't want to put themselves out there because they got nothing to win. You try to recalibrate them. So you say, let's say it's a wrestler, and you say, yeah, here's your next opponent. Man, that guy's really good. I think if you prepare well and go out there and give it your all, I think you have a pretty good chance of beating him. You make it uncertain.
Right.
And then he says, then you kind of insult them by proxy and you say, by the way, their coach thinks their guy's going to smoke you. He thinks you got nothing and the guy's just going to crush you. So now they have something to prove to the other coach and you're kind of insulting them, but you're not doing it. You know, so if you're the parent, you don't want to poison your relationship by telling your kid, I think you're going to get crushed by this guy. Like, that's probably not good for your relationship. But you still get to poke them and stimulate them by saying, oh, I heard the coach said he's going to kill you. He's just going to crush you. So now the kid's a little fired up. I'm going to show them. And he's got something to win. And you're not saying, I know you could beat this guy. Because once you say, I know, now they have nothing to go for. There's no win. If you go, I think you can, and you qualified. If you really prepare well and put out a good effort, he's tough, but I think you can beat him.
So you've coached a lot of fighters.
Yeah.
I feel that a very common thing, though, is to do not what you said, to say, oh, you're going to win, you're awesome, you're going to, you know, sort of, I don't know if you've done it or not, but I feel like I've heard it a lot. I don't know from you.
It's very tricky, you know, because that's the standard advice that you hear. I was watching Ben Askren, the wrestler and MMA fighter. I have a lot of respect for him. He's really great wrestler, very good MMA fighter. He puts out a Monday, Mental Monday Facebook thing where he gives little tips about coaches and things. And one time he put, you got to keep giving your kids positive reinforcement and tell them they can achieve anything. Keep telling them to achieve anything. And then he gives two examples. So listen to the examples. He goes, you know, I went to Missouri and people told me that was dumb. I should go to a more wrestling-oriented school, and I was screwing up my whole career in wrestling. And then I made it to the national championships and I was a national champion. So I showed them, which is not what he just said.
Yeah, that's not what he said.
And then he referenced another wrestler who was a walk-on, and everyone told him he could never make it, and he was wasting his time even trying. And not only did he make the team, he became a national champion. So that's the exact opposite. So it's so strange. The two examples he gave were the complete opposite. So you kind of need that. You have to have something to prove. If you got nothing to earn, you're not going to go for it. It's that old, we're going to move toward pleasure, away from pain, and conserve energy. Why are you going to spend energy if there's nothing to gain? You know what I mean? It just doesn't make any sense. The human nervous system doesn't work that way.
So do you think it's a balancing act, basically, you know, of giving the right amount of positive feedback?
Yes.
And about the right things, like about effort and about preparation.
I agree. Yes,
as opposed to just the
blanket.
Like, you're awesome. You're right. You're great.
Yeah, we have this weird thing in our culture where we think we're building our child's esteem by telling them, oh, you can do anything, you're wonderful, and I'll love you no matter what you do, and this type of thing. I don't know if that's the best approach, right?
Yeah. You tell your child, I may love you.
I might.
Depends how you do. It depends.
Well, that's it's so weird, but the word love is so obtuse. Like, what do you mean when you say that to your kid, you know?
But I also think it goes beyond, you know, you're the best, you're awesome, you're everything.
Yeah. I think you're realistic when you tell somebody. Aren't you helping somebody when you're realistically assessing their capabilities in a field?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of you know, it's not that simple. Like, I also have seen people apply this to like a four-year-old, where I feel like, just tell the four-year-old they're great. They're a little kid, you know? So you don't, you know, it depends, you know, if it's a four-year-old.
You mean you don't want
swinging a golf club? You're like, ah, you're great. You know, what's the difference at that point? You know, you don't have to.
Oh, that's relative. Yeah. If they're doing a good job.
Yeah.
But if the four-year-old's not doing a good job, I mean, what's a good job for a four-year-old? They're actually trying to do it. That's good.
Yeah.
Good try. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
I just don't think you need to be too harsh for like a four-year-old in general. You know?
No, I agree. I think I always thought that when I give criticism to my children or to a student, that at some level I'm harming the relationship when I criticize them, even if it's realistic and to their benefit. So I have to establish a solid enough bond with them that they trust me enough that the relationship can take a little bit of a hit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I'll try to build it up afterwards. And
that's interesting too, is it? Because also, even roll any of that martial arts, jiu-jitsu, it's hard. And if you're losing at it, you kind of don't want to hear criticism in a way. At least for me, like if you're actually getting someone just choked you, you don't really want to hear like, that was terrible. Because you're like, you know, I just got choked.
But on the other hand, if you give non-credible praise, you lose all credibility. If you're getting your head handed to you and I go, you're doing wonderfully, Dan. You're like, well, you're insane.
Yeah.
And you have no credibility. I don't care what you think. Your kids, I don't know if your kids, but I think it's common if kids sense that the parents are giving praise too easily and not connected to reality, they just dismiss the parent completely.
I have this image in a fight if someone is literally like punching you in the face and you're like, you're doing great. Good job. Like, I'm literally getting beaten bloody.
Like, I like the way that you turned your nose just a few inches so it hit you in the eyeball instead of the nose. That was clever. Very good.
But again, you can give, it's all about advice instead of maybe criticizing or complimenting, right? You just...
Advice. Yeah, I think so. You do it constructively and realistically.
I think we've talked about that, or a lot of people talked about that, about the cornering and fighting where... Especially back in the day where a lot of the cornering would be like, get up, or like this, like there'd be no...
I like it when they go, breathe.
Breathe.
Breathe. And the guy keeps yelling, breathe.
Yeah, just yelling stuff that you know the fighter is like not listening. You know, it's meaningless to
the fighter. I went to a fight years ago. Where was it? It was in Revere, Mass. I mean, a long time ago. It must have been 10 years ago maybe or something. I think it was probably 10 years ago. It was the funniest fights I've ever been to. So... I don't know if I told you this story. So it was in Club Lido, I think it was like a little nightclub, and they put up a cage. And these guys came out. It was so crazy. And the corner man kept yelling, punch him in the face! Punch him in the face! And that's all he was yelling. But he did not stop it. Did not stop it. And then the fighter was actively listening to all the instruction, which is fun. So the fighter's on top of the guy somehow. He's on top of his opponent. And he looks over and he... punch him in the face for the 70th time, he says it. And he looks down and he punches the guy in the face. And then there was a pause of time, and the guy in the corner goes, punch him in the face. His guy won, so I guess he was doing a good job.
But I've heard at all levels, I've actually heard fighters yell back, like, you know, be like, get up, out of there. I've heard fighters yell back, like, I'm trying. Or like, I
can't.
That's
very funny. You know? I think that happened in one of Javi's fights, one of our guys who's really good fighter, good at grappling. It was a heavyweight fight. And he had the guy on his back in the last round, and he was pinning the guy and pummeling the poor guy. And his corner kept yelling, get up, get up. And as he's getting punched in the face, he's like, I'm trying, but he's really good. Yeah. And like two punches land in between all of that. Yeah.
I remember the story.
He's too good. That's what he said. Yeah. He was a tough guy, and he was trying, but he couldn't get it. It wasn't that easy.
The worst advice, like, you're like, I'm trying. You know, how do I? Right. You need to give actual advice.
Yes. And if you're not skilled and you're looking from the outside, it seems weird. Like, you think the guy should be able to just get up at any moment. But obviously, his opponent's making it really hard for him.
Although, I will say the one thing on the credit of people giving, like, coaching is that sometimes it actually, like, what sounds like idiot coaching works. I've seen you do it. I've been on the receiving end of it. I've seen you do it.
You've seen me do idiot coaching?
No. Well, which sounds like, but just this simple, like, we're making fun of yelling, get up, right?
Right.
But I've seen it. I've been on one side where someone, like, I don't know if it's really you or not, but you're sort of tired, you're exhausted, and the guy's maybe a little off balance, and you're not going, and you can yell, like, get up, get up, get up. And you're like, you feel that little... And you do get up.
Yeah.
So it can sound like we're making fun of everybody that yells get up or go. Or
no.
Just go, 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 go. And it actually works.
A lot of times that's the best coaching you can do, because the athlete is in a moment where they're thinking, and then they hear that from the coach and they go, I'm going to stop thinking. I'm just going to get up and go. And they get a good result. Yeah, that is good coaching. Definitely. Well, Dan, I think we might have come to the end of another podcast.
Did
I didn't get through
already. What numbers did we do?
It looks like we did 1, 2, sort of 3, 5. Yeah, and
we got about a dozen more.
We got about a dozen more.
That's good. We're trying to talk about the power of the tribe, right? It's good to have some examples.
We get a lot more to come, and we got some great stories. We're going to have a lot of laughs, and I think it makes a difference. I'm so glad I have the tribe that I have. One of the points that I have on here is when you're helping others. So sometimes if you're not feeling good, but you belong to a real tribe like this and you help somebody else out, it gets you out of that not feeling great about your circumstances or yourself for the moment. You know, like you have this motor of conscientiousness going, why this happened and why is this happening? And you're just feeling crappy and you're just going over and over, but you have to snap out of it to help somebody else. And then you realize, hey, things aren't really that bad.
And I think it's very common throughout the world, right? Of people sort of sitting at home and feeling all alone, you know, and I just think
that's the worst, right?
Yeah. I mean, this, you know, people that, you know, you hear about anyone that everyone complains about going to work. And then the most common thing you hear about once they're not working is like this loneliness, and you know, and they just feel that sitting home and brooding.
Yeah. So I would say to anybody who's out there listening to this podcast and you feel a little alone, just come in, send me a message or come into the academy and we'll welcome you. We're a very open group and we'll help you make any change you want to make in your life. And very least, you will not feel as lonely as you might be feeling now. And that is key. That's the key to feeling better and making any positive change in your life. You really can't do it at home all alone, for sure. So I'm going to wrap it up here, Dan. Thanks so much. That was another great podcast. So, folks, this is Power of the Tribe podcast. Do me a favor. Go on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. Subscribe to the podcast. Please give us a glowing review if you can. You can also go to my YouTube channel. You can contact me on Facebook or Instagram. And the academy, again, is Connors Martial Arts Academy, ConnorsMA.com. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for listening.